comments on Serotalk Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Welcome to the latest Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotalk Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft. On TechChat 103, taking it to the great outdoors, we're speaking with Lawrence Utenier.
Yeah, you got her.
Hanging out in Canada, taking his work public, not something that just every person does, but he runs blindfishingboat.com. Why don't you talk about what is Blind Fishing Boat? What are you doing?
You know, I love fishing. I've always loved fishing, and it's something I just got better at over the years as my eyesight deteriorated. About 5 years ago, I figured I'm going to take my love public. No, it's not a porn site. Don't get excited. It's just me and telling stories about being on the water fishing, and with the aim of trying to get other people with vision loss interested in taking up the sport and people with sight interested in the idea of taking someone with vision loss.
Okay, so how much vision do you have?
I have nothing.
You peruse the water, so I guess the first, being a tech show, we have to talk about the equipment, the technology that you use to help you do that safely and effectively.
The boat. The boat is my main lure. It gets me more interest in the message I'm trying to deliver. I like to think of it as the ultimate bait. But what it is, it's a 12-foot folding plastic boat made in California by Port-A-Boat, and they've made over 80,000 of these boats. It folds up to be 4 inches thick, and so it's quite easily put on your rooftop. It weighs about 70 pounds. Unfolded, it's 5 feet wide, 12 feet long, and 2 feet deep. I run an electric Minn Kota trolling motor on it, so it gives me about 5 miles an hour. I put a little sensor on the front of the boat. It's one of these mini guides, and I Velcro that onto the front of the boat and plug a little speaker into it. It gives me a range of about 30, 35 feet on the water. I have a talking depth sounder, a few different ones I've been experimenting with, and so it tells me how deep the water is below the boat. I use a talking compass to get the boat pointed in the direction I want to go, one of those Columbus talking compasses, about $50. And I use a talking GPS to record my waypoints. So first I'll maybe I'll go out with someone, my wife or a buddy, and I'll record some waypoints just off the launch and then some other things like a weed bed, maybe a point or something. And once I got my waypoints, I can sort of navigate point to point using the directions from the GPS.
What about unexpected obstacles, things that might be in the water?
Underwater, I'm not too worried. I mean, I pretty well know how deep the water is under my boat all the time. So if it gets really shallow, I'm going to slow down to maybe 1, 2, 3 miles an hour. And being that the boat is made out of this really sort of super tough polypropylene, it can bounce off rocks, logs, stumps. It's made for bouncing off stuff like that. So, and it's a very quiet boat. It's like a sensor, you know. I like to think of it as my sensor. Whereas other people drive around in their boats avoiding things, I drive up to things, touch it, feel it, smell it, taste it, and then move on. So I'm really probing around out there. I look a little bit maybe drunk when I'm driving, but I'm not. And I have a big sign on the side of the boat, blind fishing boat. So as I pass by, people see what's going on, and yeah, everyone gets quite a kick out of it. And you know, most of it though, you do it by your hearing. You hear what's around you. Say if another boat drives by, a gas boat, you can hear that gas boat where it came from, where it's going. So you get right away, you get an idea of the length of the lake. And then as the wake rolls up on the shore around you, you get an idea of the exact parameter of the body of water that you're on just by the sound of those three waves rolling up onto the shore. Three-dimensional vision in your head of what's around you. You'll hear someone banging, you know, doing some handyman work on their deck or something around the cottage. You might hear some kids playing on a beach somewhere else. Hear a dog barking somewhere else. There's always birds in the trees and winds in the trees and frogs chirping near the lily pads. There's a billion different sounds that'll key you into and keep you oriented. The wind in your face is another one. The waves, you know, the way the waves are traveling, that's definitely another one. The wind and the waves, that's a key one, especially if you're on a body of water where there's nothing around.
That's my next question. What about storms?
Yeah, I figure if I ever get stuck in a lightning storm, I'm going to go up like a sparkler with all the electronics I'm carrying around. But I try to beat it in before that happens.
Do you use like NOAA weather, or you actually have some kind of talking radar to tell the proximity of storms, or do you tell by the waves of the water?
Just my nose. You can smell a storm coming. You know, the ozone, it gets a little cooler. Wind freshens up. You can hear some rumbling maybe in the distance. I'm not miles and miles offshore. You don't have to go far to catch fish. Everyone thinks you have to get in your boat and drive to the other end of the lake. Well, the guys at the other end of the lake are thinking the same thing, and they're showing up at your end of the lake and fishing. So really, I mean, if you get out away from the launch and you're, you know, anywhere within a mile, you're going to catch lots of fish. I mean, there's lots. If you can't catch fish within a mile of the launch, there's no fish.
So what type of fish are you catching?
I'm really lucky around here. We have some great rivers and lakes. So lake trout, rainbow trout, speckle trout, you know, walleye, pickerel, pike, muskie, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, panfish, crappie, salmon in the Great Lakes. I fish on the East Coast and West Coast as well. I've caught sturgeon, shark, sailfish. I was just down catching sailfish, filming a TV show with a guy who has his own hunting fishing show on Versus, Fred Barta. And we went down there for 9 days, and I was catching these sailfish using the bait-and-switch method, which is pretty cool.
So are you eating most of these or throwing them back or selling them? What are you doing with the fish once you catch them?
That's a good question. 99.9% of the fish I catch, I throw back. You know, the sailfish we were catching off Guatemala, if a captain brings in a dead billfish, which is, could be a marlin or a sailfish, he has a $5,000 fine. It's always a good idea to let the big ones go for sure, because they're the breeders, and if you do want to keep some, keep the pound, you know, 1 pound, 2 pound fish. They're the best eaters. They're young. They're not full of toxic substances. You know, they haven't been around for eons, collecting all sorts of toxic waste in their system, in their flesh. So you want to eat the young fish. They're not the breeders anyways, and they're the ones that taste better. So it's all, yeah, I don't mind having a little shore lunch for sure.
So when you go out, how long of a period at one time? I mean, how far can you travel based on fuel you can take?
I have two deep cycle electric batteries. That'll last me easily all day. I mean, I'm not running full speed all day. I run full speed. I slow down. I probe around. I stop. I throw out the anchor. Fish, move, fish, move, fish. I can easily go for 12 hours. I carry a two-way radio. So if there's someone on shore that I'm camping with or something, they can always get a hold of me. You know, let me know if it's getting too dark and they can't see me anymore, if I should be getting in or something. 12 hours on the water, it's totally doable. You know, in 12 hours on the water, and it's so quiet, it's so peaceful, and you have this contact with the water and the air and the sun and the elements. You feel these fish biting, you know, and attacking your bait, and then you struggle, and then you have them in the net, and then you're in your hands as you release them, and you put them back in the water, and you're having that contact with this live nature. It's probably one of the most zen-like experiences I'll ever have. I just love it. I highly, highly recommend it.
What about certain times that are better for fishing?
Yeah, it's fishing, not catching, right? So, I mean, there's days where you can go and you're not catching anything. Some guy told me this. I was fishing the America Cup International Fly Fishing Tournament last September in Breckenridge, Colorado. And I actually caught the second largest fish of the tournament and caught some nice fish. I didn't win it, but I did pretty good. And all on a fly rod. And he said, when I teach someone to fly fish, he said, there's go through five stages. The first one is they want to catch a fish. The next thing, they want to catch lots of fish. Third, they want to catch a big fish. Fourth, they want to catch lots of big fish. And fifth, they just want to go fishing. But even when I'm fishing in a tournament, the novices, they'll want to catch their five fish bass limit really quick as they can, and they're panicking unless they have five fish in the live well. And then they'll slow down, and then they'll start catching bigger fish and replacing the smaller ones with the bigger ones. But they're really panicking to get those first five in. I go for five good bites in a day. I know I need to get five good fish. I want to have five good bites. I don't care if I catch, you know, little fish. I don't want to catch little fish. I just want to have five good big fish bite my hook and get them into the boat and work that way. It's a different way of fishing.
So what do you use for the actual fishing process?
There's some really cool technology made for people who love fishing that has nothing to do with blindness, but it's totally, totally suited for people with vision loss. Like, if you think about it, what's a fishing rod? A fishing rod is nothing more than a $500 cane wrapped with some guides to hold the fishing line and a seat to hold the fishing reel. It really is nothing more than that. It's a sensor. Sure, it launches your bait and holds your fishing reel, but really, it's nothing more than a sensor. Some people, amateurs, you know, people who get too excited or whatever, they'll grip the fishing rod like a spear or a club, and, you know, their knuckles are turning white, and they're not feeling nothing. They're just sight fishing. They're waiting for the tip to jiggle, their line to jerk, and they're going to set the hook, and it's totally a visual experience for them. But for professionals, you know, the people who are making all the money in the tournaments, they use their rods like an instrument. It's a sensor, it's a tool, and you have to hold it like that. It has to be well balanced. You hold it lightly in your hand, and you feel everything around you. When I show up on a piece of water, first bait I'll throw is a spinner bait. And these spinner baits are designed to be totally weedless. You can fish them at all depths. So I'll start and I'll throw 360 degrees. You know, I'll move 10 degrees left, 10 degrees left, 10 degrees left, throw it out, let it sink. I'll just bring it in on close to the surface. And I'll be catching fish while I'm doing this. But I'm also getting an idea of what's around my boat for 100 feet diameter, all around the boat. And then I'll do the same thing and I'll let the spinner bait sink maybe 2 or 3 feet below the surface. Now I'll bring it in then. So I know, okay, what's below the surface. Then I'll do it again. I'll let it sink maybe 8 feet. And then I'll start to feel what's below, what's on the bottom. Is it weedy down there? Are there stumps, rocks, mud, sand, gravel? You can feel all of that with your fishing rod and some good fishing line and your spinnerbait. You get a real sense. Oh, now you've got this whole visual image of this 200 diameter wide circle around your boat. And you have a really good idea of what's around. You know where the weed beds are. You know where the rocky points are. You know where there's nothing. Once you do that, then I zone in on that, and I'll throw some plastics. I'll fish what I call vertical, straight up and down, and a jig or some weighted plastics, and I'll sink that down into those spots that I found where I think there's fish. You know, and it's usually structures, a pile of rocks, something. I'll slow it right down, and I'll just drop things down into those areas, and the fish will come out and bonk. And you feel that tap, that bite, that tug, that pressure. You set the hook, you reel in, you got yourself fish. So, you know, there's a bunch of different ways. My favorite way of fishing for bass is with these frogs. Like Snag Proof makes these frogs. They're like rubber squeaky toys. You throw them out, they float on the water, you throw them right on top of the lily pads, and then you just drag them back across on top of the lily pads. And you gotta not set the hook when you hear the bass come out of the water, and you know, because they're coming straight up, grabbing your frog, flying straight up in the air with your frog in their mouth. And if you set the hook at that point when you hear the fish, you're just pulling it out of their mouth like you're pulling a tea bag out of a teacup. So you got to wait for that fish to turn around 180, head back down. Now the fish is facing away from me. Now you can set the hook. So the hook has a chance of lodging in the corner of the mouth. But you also have to turn that fish around again 180 degrees. Otherwise, you're going to be all tangled up in the weeds. So it's a pretty exciting way of fishing. That's all about timing, using your ears, listening close, and making sure you just set that hook just at the right time. It's not hard to do. You just have to control your excitement. There's some scientific reports saying that sounds in the dark are 5 times scarier if you don't see where they're coming from. You know, fish and frogs at nighttime, or like me without any sight, it's really cool. It's quite a thrill.
One of the big questions people always ask about, what's the ultimate bait? But does it depend upon what you're trying to catch?
Match the hatch. You know, there's no point fishing frogs if there's no lily pads or weed cover around, because there's not going to be frogs. You got to sort of have an idea of what the fish are feeding on. Are they feeding near the bottom? And you can figure that out. Color isn't that important. I generally go with black lures, white, or very natural color greens and browns if the water's really clear and it's sunny. If the water's stained or dirty, then I go with those really bright lures and slow it down even more, because the fish have to hear it. They're not fishing by sight anymore. Always the trick is the fish are looking up, so they need to silhouette your lure. So black lures silhouette against a very gray sky nicely, whereas a light lure will blend in with the gray sky. So you want to have a dark lure at night or on dark days. Natural colors on clear days and with bright sun, because you don't want the fish to see it too clearly, and you want them to think that it's natural looking, not some hideous fluorescent something or another. And then when it's really inky water, you got to have something that's a little brighter, so they see that little flash of color when they hear that thumping or strumming or some sort of noise come through the water. They see a little glint of color and they can target in and attack it.
I know some people, you look at things like the barometric pressure. How relevant is that?
Fishing is always good when the storm coming. Fish don't know if it's going to be the monsoon of a century or if it's just a little, you know, spring shower. You know, they don't read the weather reports. They don't have any idea. So they're always going to think, got to eat now, because if it rains really hard for the next 2 days, everything's going to get really dirty and I'm not going to find any food. So they're always going to start to feed up when the storm's moving in. And then as the storm hits, they're going to sort of slow down a little bit. 3 days of any weather in a row, that third day the fishing will come back. You know, so if it's been storming for 3 days, the fish will come back on the third day. They'll be hungry again. If it's been sunny for 3 days, it's always the third day of any steady weather is the best day. Just ahead of those storm fronts is for sure is good fishing.
Let's assume you inspire some folks to go out and try this on their own, even if it's just going down to their favorite fishing hole with a pole and their bait and see what they can do based on the tips you've given them, or maybe they actually want to go out boating. What are some safety tips, just some things that people need to keep in mind in terms of cost?
People always want to start off taking someone fishing with bobbers. And bobbers are those little floats, and then they put a worm on a hook and a sinker, and it floats below the bobber, and then you watch for the bobber to start jiggle, 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 and goes underwater, and you got a fish. It's a lot of fun for people with sight to fish with bobbers. Very not fun for people with vision loss. I mean, because you're depending on the sighted person sitting next to you to tell you when you're catching a fish. And if they're catching fish and you're not, you're wondering, how much are they paying attention to my bobber? It's a real dependency thing. It's not fun. Nix the bobbers. Get yourself some other gear, some spinner baits, weedless spinner baits, or some plastic Senkos, and you can rig those up weedless. And you can fire those all over the place. Not expensive stuff. Any good spin cast rod, a Zebco, you know, push button reel, or Shimano's a good rod. I use bait casters a lot, you know, where you use your thumb on the spool, and that's totally doable. Fishing on from shore or from a dock, totally right on. Nothing wrong with that. You can wade a little bit. I use a retractable dog leash. I clip my dog to the leash and shove the handle into my waistband of my waders, and I'll wade out 10, 15 feet. My dog, you know, he's not a big swimmer, so he just stays on shore, but I always know where the shore is because I'm connected to the dog that way. You know, you don't need to get your own boat. There's always guys who have an empty seat in the boat looking to split the gas. But if you're going to get invited to go with someone in their boat, you got to split the gas, right? Because that's just the way people do it. You know, you want to get invited back for that second trip, third trip, fourth trip. They're going to invite you back if you take care of the gas, buy the breakfast. It's a win-win situation for both people. Once you're on the boat, you're on your own, and you don't need a lot of hand-holding. It's easy to tie knots, to put your line through the eye of the hook. You can just use your tip of your tongue to guide the line through the eye of the hook. It works really well, or you can use a little crochet hook you can get at Walmart or somewhere like that for a couple bucks. Very good for pulling the line through the eyes of the hooks. Learning to tie knots, not a big deal, and you won't poke yourself with a hook. I mean, you always know there are hooks there, so you just pay attention. I meet a lot of people with vision loss who love fishing but are always complaining that they don't get to go fishing enough. Well, no one gets to go fishing enough. And everyone, sighted or not, always wants to go fishing with the guy who really knows how to catch fish. It's like dating, right? You always want to date the hot chick, you know? No difference with fishing. It has nothing to do with whether you got sight or not. You want to fish with people that are as good as you or better than you. You want to learn something. You want to have fun. You want to have a little competition. So you got to learn to fish a little bit. You got to get good at it. Hanging out at the fishing store, you know, and going to the pier and just fishing off the pier and off the docks, off the riverbanks. Learn to fish. And then once you learn to fish and you meet someone who's you think is about as good as you at fishing, that's probably someone that you have a good chance of going fishing with.
So when did you start? I mean, have you always been blind, or did you lose your sight later in life?
I was registered blind at age 8 and just lost the center part of my vision. They didn't know why, but it was some sort of degeneration of the macula. And in my 20s, I went blind for the second time because at that point, I couldn't magnify enough anymore to see. So I had to learn to live life without looking. So I learned to read Braille, touch type, got some audio books going, got a dog, skipped the white cane thing altogether. Still really don't know how to use a white cane 27 years later. And now I'm in my mid-40s, and I'm at the point where I just, like I said, just lost my light perception pretty much in the last 5 years or so. So I figure that's the third part of going blind now, and third time blind, I figure.
So at any time did you go through a depression, or did you just say, well, here's what I've got to work with, I'll use what I've got?
In grade 3, going from being a regular kid, popular, to being labeled as different, you know, that was a while ago, right? So, I mean, teachers weren't very tolerant then either, and that was a tough time socially. And I still was a regular kid as far as I was concerned, did everything else the other kids did, just couldn't figure out why they didn't. I went from being popular to being unpopular. In my 20s, having to pick up that white cane or a dog and admit to people that I was, you know, quote-unquote blind, people's attitudes changed so much when I came home with a dog. It's like, oh, Lawrence, you went blind. No, I've been blind for a long time. I just lost a little more sight. I need to have something now in the evenings. All these attitudes from family, and that was a weird time in my life for sure. And now, you know, I mean, people just assume that I've been blind for quite a while, and because I have a dog. But now losing that window on the world, I think that's the psychological challenge. That's one I'm still sort of getting used to, and it's a little different. And my mom always said, if you're feeling down and crappy, let's clean the house, you know, do something. Exercise every day, that's a big one. That really helps me get through any tough times. Good day for me, I go through a whole day, I don't even think I'm blind. I have a good job, found myself in a job and customized it. This fishing thing, heck, everyone's fishing blind. Everyone's trying to see underwater. No one can. They're all wearing polarized glasses, buying $2,000 fish finders to try to see underwater. And then what are they seeing? Little streaks and blobs on their fuzzy displays. Can't see underwater. We're all blind on the water. So fishing, really, it's so cool that way. I mean, you get out on a boat with someone, you're fishing, and no one sees the fish until you catch them. That's just the way it goes. I mean, you can see birds, you can hear birds, you know, you can see turtles and stuff on top of the water, but most fishing is blind.
So there's nothing that replaces the ultimate hands-on, get the feel of it, but I'm curious of any useful either online websites or podcasts or online materials.
I'll have to plug my own website, I guess. All websites have to do with fishing, but none have to do with fishing without sight. I put up a website, blindfishandboat.com, and I have a Facebook page too. And there's tons of articles there, tons of information. It's categorized all 18 different ways so you can get information on the boats, the electronics I'm using, the different gear, the different types of fishing, and on and on and on. So there's techniques. I write articles now for other people, other mainstream fishing magazines, and I do seminars on Feel the Bite, where I talk to sighted people about how to get more out of their equipment and what does it mean when they feel this and when they feel that, trying to describe to them from my experience what these different sensations mean through their sense of touch. And that's pretty cool. I think we got an advantage, you know, over the sighted people. Sighted people are always looking around at the dock and who's on the docks and who's on the other boats and what are they doing on the other boats and the birds. And you know, when you start looking around like that when you're fishing, you're not catching fish. Someone without sight, their hands or their eyes, so what's in their hands are their fishing rod, so they're focused on that fishing rod quite steadily, and for that they're catching. My experiences in organizing fishing adventures for other people with vision loss, pairing them up with sighted people, they catch 2 to 3 more fish than the sighted person. The technology, I think the GPS thing made it possible for me to get out my own boat. And that was something I'd been working on for different companies for quite a number of years to get that GPS thing straightened out. And it's still not perfect, but it certainly helps. You know, if you want to get out in the water, I kayak. I have a belly boat. I have that 12-foot porta boat. And I also have a 18-foot Ranger with 175 horsepower Evinrude on it that I fish with my sighted partners, but I don't drive it. You know, I mean, my sighted partners drive the boat. And here's where I always often get in a little bit of trouble. Honestly, I've done a lot of sports, downhill skiing, kayaking, canoeing, sailing, blind sailing, a lot of these blind activity kind of events. And I really think fishing is one of those rare opportunities where having no vision is almost an advantage over people with vision. And there's not that many activities out there where you can say that, but fishing really is one of them. And so I think it's a great equalizer. It's a great inherently accessible sport. I don't know why there isn't more people with vision loss doing it, but they do it. That's for sure. I mean, there's that big fishing tournament in North Carolina every October. I won it last year. 500 people from 11 different states were there, all blind. But you know what? Because fishing is such an accessible sport, you don't need to do it as a blind party, right? You don't need to do it as a community. I meet so many young people exhibiting at sportsman shows and outdoor shows, blind people and their parents and so on. They don't want to necessarily hang around, you know, with other people with vision loss. It's like a convention of bald people, right? It's not a reason to them to get together. They want to do stuff with their friends from school and their buddies, and fishing is one of those things. So, you know, you don't need to have a special training. You don't need to have special rules or special equipment. You don't need to have a blind fishing boat to go fishing. You just need a fishing rod and a seat in a boat with a buddy. That's it.
I wonder, would there be any advantage, or would this be the last thing on your mind to say, maybe in addition to GPS, you could have like a Android or iPhone out there or something, and that way, if you just got in a situation you needed some visuals, you could actually Skype and, you know, point the phone around and let others see kind of what you're looking at out there.
Yeah, like there's that guy, I can't remember his name, he's in California. He's developing that technology where he wears a head camera and it's hooked wireless to an internet so people can watch what he's looking at. And he's, you know, skiing, he's sailing, he's riding bikes using this technology. And then he has two-way audio communications as well with the person behind the computer, so they can tell him, what are you looking at? It's pretty cool technology. It's not mainstream yet, but maybe, you know, when that sort of thing comes out, that's going to be a cool thing. You just have to have coverage, right? There's going to be breakthroughs. There's no doubt about it.
Now, what part of Canada are you in, and how many local lakes do you have?
Yeah, I'm in Ottawa, Canada's capital city. It's the fourth largest city in Canada. It's right central eastern time zone, just north of the St. Lawrence River, about 100 miles. If you know Canada, you heard of Montreal and Toronto, where I'm about halfway between those two cities. We have the Ottawa River, the Gatineau River, and the Rideau River coming together right here in Ottawa. And then there's lakes and a canal system, just tons of lakes. I really am blessed in terms of the the types of fish. Mind you, when I get the chance to go and fish in the saltwater, saltwater fish are so much more aggressive. There's nowhere for fish to hide in the ocean, so they're always swimming for their life, and bigger fish are always trying to eat smaller fish, so everything's trying to eat everything else. The only way you survive is by being fast. So fish in the ocean fight like crazy, have tons of power. And then you come back and fish in a lake or a river where fish have plenty of places to hide. They're used to just, you know, popping out, grabbing something, popping back in. So they don't have as much of the stamina as saltwater fish. You quickly readjust, you know. It's always fun to catch a fish.
Do you mind if people email you, or do you have the website?
Check me out on Facebook, Blind Fishing Boat, and email me if you have a story you want to share. Be happy to share it on my blog site, the blindfishingboat.com site, info@blindfishingboat.com.
What do you do when you're not fishing? What do you have career-wise? What do you do with the rest of your time? And you said you have a wife and a puppy. That's always good times.
Yeah, well, I dream about fishing. No, I got a great wife and some kids, a couple grandkids. I got a job in the government. Yeah, it's going to pave my way to full-time fishing at some point when I retire. Guy without a hobby, you know, is not a fulfilled guy. Man or women, you got to have a good hobby. And you know what? If I could fish for a living, full out, flat out, I would. I would for sure. I'd do it. Right now, what I'm working on is a documentary. I have a master's degree in environmental studies, and I really feel strongly about our fishing heritage and the future of fishing and the future of fish and marine ecosystems. So I'm doing a documentary right now on the these ecosystems across Canada and what's happening to our marine environments and these wild fish stocks.
And then how will you distribute that?
We're going to go through the theaters, the documentary theaters. There's 300 in the U.S. And then once we do a run on that, then we'll put it onto, we got some broadcasters interested in some mainstream networks on picking it up.
Well, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, hopefully. I got a lot of filming to do this summer. I got about 25 days of filming to do this summer in about 8 different locations across Canada.
Lawrence, I promised to only keep you a half hour. I appreciate the info. I know a lot of folks will be interested in this. This is much larger than I thought. I knew a few blind folks here and there who fish on occasion. Like you said, they can't get out there enough. Again, just another example, folks. We try to speak with people to let you know that anything's possible if you can imagine it. Put it in the eye of your mind and off you go.
Do it. It's just the greatest way to touch nature. People can say, oh, look at that deer or look at that squirrel, or and you can hug a tree. But when you can feel that fish bite the end of your line and hold that fish in your hands, you don't get any closer to nature than that. It's just amazing.
Thanks a lot, Lawrence. Maybe we'll have you back on in the future. It'd be great to talk more. And
yeah, appreciate it.
Do you feel like your sleep patterns are different from the rest of the world? Do you sometimes feel the unwanted urge or need to fall asleep during the day, even when you need to be awake? Do you also feel just too wide awake to fall or stay asleep during the night? If you are blind, this could be a real sleep problem related to a lack of light needed to keep your body in sync. Learn more about an ongoing clinical research study that is evaluating a new investigational treatment for this type of sleep problem. When calling, you can also complete a short sleep survey. When calling, you must be between 18 and 75 years of age and totally blind. Volunteers will be compensated for their participation in the clinical study and will receive study-related medication, medical evaluations, and transportation at no cost. If you or someone you know might be affected, call toll-free 1-888-389-7033 or email info@non24registry.com. That's info@non24registry.com.
And on Tech Chat 103, as we go to the great outdoors, now speaking with Nolan Derelict, and we are talking about biking and hiking and using GPS technology to make your way as you do this. So first of all, Nolan, bring us up to speed on what you do. What are your outdoor fun activities?
Outdoor fun activities, let's see. I have done a lot of camping over the last few years, not as much recently as I would have liked, but I've done a lot of camping in the past. I do a lot of walking, and I've recently kind of been adding hiking to that regimen. Recently, I have actually taken up, actually I haven't started yet, but I'm going to in the near future, solo biking, which is something that we should definitely talk about tonight, because I think there are some techniques that people can use that they may not be aware of, or they may be aware of, but they're not familiar with how they can apply to being able to bike in some situations on your own, and it really enlightened me when I realized that I can do that. So that's something I'm really excited about taking on in the near future. And as we talked about, GPS is something I use pretty heavily in most of those activities.
You know, as you're moving with some speed, how you anticipate things like hills and rocks and obstacles that may be in your way. And you also mentioned hiking, and I assume you do a lot of that as you're camping.
As I'm camping, yeah, and I'm starting to kind of add just random hiking on trails. There are some interesting adaptive cane techniques that you can use with hiking, which I haven't actually learned yet, or at least not learned fully, but there are some techniques you can use with a cane and a trekking pole, or even apparently no cane and two trekking poles, which I'm not really familiar with how that works, but apparently that's sort of a hardcore blind hiker technique, which I hope to learn in the not-too-distant future, because I think it seems kind of interesting.
Okay, so let's start then with the technology that we would need. What's some modern-day stuff really cool that we should look at if we want to go camping and hiking?
I think that an accessible GPS is definitely really useful to have. The camping that I've done in the past, there tends to be a lot of infrastructure. This is probably going to resonate with some people and totally go over other people's heads, but I identify as a burner, which means I go to local burns and things like that. And what that translates to for people who are not familiar with that technology is it tends to be very art-focused. It tends to be very focused on going out into the middle of nowhere and bringing a lot of infrastructure. So bringing electricity to do dance installations and things like that. That kind of tends to help out with the technology front, because if somebody has a generator that they're using to power lights and such, it's not really much trouble to hook in a charger and charge up a GPS. So one thing that I've really found is helpful is using GPS in that situation, because you tend to not have as many landmarks as you would have on a city street. So you don't have intersections, you don't have businesses that you're familiar with, parking lots that you're familiar with. You just have a lot of open space. For years, I've used a trekker, and in more recent times, I'm using a GPS solution that I'm developing. But what I found when I used a trekker was that it really changed how I engaged with the trip. And what I mean by that, I would mark a camp, or I would mark a spot for the pool, or I would mark a spot for the lake, or for camp that I found where they, I don't know, maybe made breakfast tacos in the morning and I wanted to go have a taco or something. So I'd mark these spots, and it changed completely how I would travel, because I could decide at any point in the day, hey, I'm going to go to the pool, and I don't necessarily know where the pool is from here, but my GPS does, so I can get it to tell me, you know, the pool is 320 degrees, 500 feet or something. And having that information was incredibly helpful. And so I went from being somebody who would camp and kind of depended on people to help me find things and help me orient to somebody who, oh, I've been to the pool once, I've marked it, I can find it again in the future. So I'd take off there. That's something that really helps. And I think while there is a lot of infrastructure here, and while that definitely helps with technology and helps with using things like GPS and having a good charge, I think that there are lots of backup batteries and things like that, especially for mobile phones, where you can buy like a 5,000 mAh battery. And that's a lot, considering that most phones have, you know, 1,500 or 1,400. So you get a couple of charges, two or three charges off of this backup battery. And that's about how many times I find myself having to charge up something over the course of a weekend. So you can actually bring your power with you if you don't have that much infrastructure, which is something I'm going to start doing in the future.
Are there wooded areas or places where your GPS or cell service, if you're using that, where it's going to become spotty or not work at all?
That would certainly be a concern, at least for cell service. I know that I've done some camps where we don't have it. And in those instances, the trekker was really useful because it is self-contained. So you have the maps on the unit and you don't actually have to connect out to a data network. That's not something that is true about the solution I'm developing, and I'm hoping to eventually make it to where it is embedded, but for now it does require a cell connection. So it's not a perfect solution, and there are things that need to be ironed out. But I'm the kind of person who I tend to design things for the future. I tend to design things with the idea, or think of things with the idea, that eventually cell phone service is going to be a lot more pervasive than it is, and data connections are going to be a lot more pervasive. So once that happens, these solutions are going to be a lot more viable in situations where they may not be currently.
So let's go back to biking. I'm fascinated with this ability to move with some speed and, you know, what you're able to pick up.
In the beginning of January, February, I was kind of toying on my own with the idea of, can I design a technology to put on a bike that would make it drivable by somebody who is blind? So maybe using ultrasonic sensors or computer vision or things like that. At the beginning of March, I read an article about a guy in California named Daniel Kish. And basically what he does is he has done pretty much since he was born, I think he's in his mid-40s now, but since birth, he's been using a form of active echolocation. So basically what he does is he moves around and he makes a very high-pitched, very discreet click, and he has trained himself to listen to the echoes that come back. and analyze them very, very detailedly, so with a lot of detail. So, for instance, hearing the echo come back and saying, okay, there's a car 20 feet ahead of me. There's a pole 3 feet to my right. There is a picket fence 5 feet to my right, and there's some bushes behind that, and there's probably a house behind that with an awning. You can get really, really detailed with a few clicks. There have been a lot of people in the past who have done this, and they've, you know, gotten varying degrees of notoriety and such. The thing I think that makes Daniel different is that he actually tried to understand the science behind this. So he didn't just say, oh yeah, here's this clicky thing and it works. He actually got a degree in developmental psychology, I believe it was, and tried to kind of figure out, okay, what's going on in my brain when I hear this? What am I picking up? And not only that, but what am I able to pick up? What is the frequency of this click? What are the audio characteristics of this click when it travels out? What is it going to find? What types of objects, how large, how far off? I mean, if you actually look at the material he's written, he's actually figured out things like, yeah, you can detect this many square inches at this distance and things like that. So there was a lot of research put into this. But what really attracted me to him and the organization that he's running is that his students are able to road bike solo and mountain bike solo in some conditions. And so I contacted him about it because I biked when I was younger and I, you know, thought that I'd live forever back then, and I'm older and I know better now. But I contacted him and said, hey, look, you know, here's my situation. I'm interested in road biking. Here's what my terrain is like. Is this something that you think I can do? And we actually had a dialogue about it. And there are some caveats. You know, it doesn't work as well on really heavily trafficked streets. So maybe, you know, if there's a lot of traffic, it's a little bit harder to hear the echoes come back and you have to be careful about that. And there are some things that it just doesn't tell you about. Like, for instance, if there was a huge drop-off in the middle of the street, which does not happen, you know, all that often, but there are occasionally situations where there might be a construction hole that's open and there aren't, you know, cones and things around it. It won't necessarily tell you that. But on roads, the conditions you get are typically predictable. There are cars, there are tree limbs, there are things like that. So in those types of situations, it's viable. Now, it's not something that you're going to race along doing at high speeds. You actually do have to travel a bit more slowly than some cyclists. And you do have to concentrate a lot. So as a matter of fact, the people I trained with basically flat out told me, I mean, it's doable, but it's not something I would do because I would have to concentrate a lot. I think I would be cool with a little bit extra concentration if, for instance, I don't have to wait an hour and a half to catch a bus to go somewhere, which does happen occasionally. I mean, some of the buses here are kind of spotty. You know, there are some caveats, there are some limitations, but I kind of see it as a viable means of getting around. And so when I flew out to do training, because I actually did go to LA at the beginning of this month and train with him for a few days, I actually was able to ride a bike successfully for a while as part of the training. And it was rough. The main issues I had were not that I didn't know where I was going. The main issues I had were that the bikes they gave me were incredibly agile. Just as I would basically think right and I'm flying off to the right because they were so agile and they were so easy to steer. And I kind of needed something that was a little bit more difficult to drive. And I think that might have actually helped me. But I mean, you know, the issues I had were not, I didn't know where I was going. The issues I had were the bike is really, really easy to control and steer. And that's kind of difficult. It's something that I think has some potential. And I'm learning this technique. And I'm kind of feeling this sense start to come to me. And I'm starting to kind of detect cars 20 and 30 feet in my path. I'm starting to kind of be able to pass a house and describe to pretty decent levels of detail, okay, there's a fence in front of this house. There's a brick wall. There's a telephone pole, you know, a few feet off to my right. There's a tree with a low canopy. There's a, you know, I'm able to do a lot with this after just a little bit of work. I'm kind of excited to see how this is going to go. And it may not go anywhere, but it may also. It's something you have to kind of try and find out.
Now, how much vision do you have?
I'm considered totally blind. I have light perception. I can kind of see things in front of me, but it's something that I really don't trust. Because one thing I'm noticing, especially now that I'm using this echolocation technique, is that sometimes I think I see a car in front of me, and it's actually not. It's actually just a pattern of light and shadow. And it may be like, you know, 10 feet ahead of me, and I think I see it, but echolocation tells me there's no car there. And it's actually a little bit disorienting because that information is all going to the visual cortex. So it's like, I feel like I'm starting to understand some concepts of vision a little bit better now, because it almost feels like how I imagine an illusion might look, like a visual illusion, because it's like, it's there. No, wait, it's not. But yeah, it looks like it's there, but no, it's not. You know, it's like this conflicting sense that I'm getting back. So it's not really useful vision, but I have enough that I could probably see a car 15 or 20 feet ahead of me if I needed to. Only in daytime conditions, though.
Okay, so let's go back to hiking and talk about what you do there, or what if the GPS fails? You still have the old-fashioned compass?
I actually don't have a compass. That's a good point. I might have to look into getting one for my phone, because those don't actually need a data connection. They can just, you know, use the magnetometer on your phone, but that's something I could definitely look into. Hiking, this also kind of ties into the echolocation stuff as well, because one of the things that we talked about when I was getting my training was alternate cane techniques when hiking, because you can't really do a typical two-point tap technique on a trail where maybe the step that you're going to take is 2 feet higher than the step that you are now, because you can't really reach out far enough ahead of you to actually analyze what you're coming up to. So there were some alternate cane techniques that we used, like, for instance, having a cane in your right hand and kind of sweeping it out ahead of you up a pretty steep incline, for instance, but then using a trekking pole immediately in front of you to kind of sweep ahead and check where your next footfall will be and see, for instance, if there's a big rock between where you are now and your next footfall, or, you know, maybe the next footfall is a crevice. You wouldn't be able to necessarily tell that with a two-point cane technique or what have you. So it's kind of using the trekking pole along with that and using it in a variety of ways. So, for instance, you know, swinging it in front of your foot and gliding it across the ground, or if you're paralleling a drop-off, you know, kind of moving the cane to the left and feeling the drop-off and feeling where it is, or making sure that there aren't any cracks between you and, you know, your next step. There's kind of an adaptive cane technique that it's really good to use in rugged conditions, and I'm not really terribly familiar with that, but it's something I'm trying to learn more about.
Okay, so explain these trekking poles.
A trekking pole is basically, you can go to a camping store or any kind of outdoor store and get them. They're basically, I think the way they're typically used is they're almost like extra limbs for hiking. So, for instance, you would take one in your right hand, one in your left, and you would walk along and use them almost like two extra limbs. So basically, at that point, you're not just walking, you're, you know, stepping with your left foot and putting the right pole forward and kind of balancing. So it's kind of like a way to take some of the weight off your back and move forward. So that's kind of one way that they're typically used. But in this instance, you're kind of using them as a cane. So it's slightly different than you would normally use them. And some of them come with weird things like tripod attachments and things like that. So they're pretty commonly available in outdoor stores and REI and things like that.
One of your most challenging tasks, either pitching the tent or do you go fishing and live off the land and get food? Or what do you do when you go camping?
I would say actually putting up a tent can be challenging because, and I don't think it's just a blindness thing. I know plenty of sighted people who have a lot of trouble putting up a tent. I went to REI about 5 or 6 years ago and I bought a tent. I think it's like an REI HD4, Half Dome 4 or something. I think that might be the model number. And this thing is super, super easy to put up. If you imagine two folding canes kind of in a cross, and they're really, really flexible, that's basically what the pole assembly is like. You basically snap them out and they extend and the elastic snaps them into place. And it's basically like you suddenly have these two really long folding canes in a cross assembly. And there's a hook hanging down from that. And basically what you do there is you hook the tent onto the hook, and then you find the corners and you hook the corners onto basically the poles of the cane, and then you bend the cane into a dome and snap it up. And that's basically all it is. It's super easy once you've done it. It's brain dead. I don't need the instructions anymore. So that's kind of one thing that I would advise people look for. Definitely, if you can afford to, buy good tents because they're going to be a lot easier to put up than bad tents, and they're going to be a lot better designed. The other thing that I would suggest looking into, and this is not something I have actually looked at, but it seems really cool, and I think I'm going to in the near future. It's a company called, I think it's Hennessy Hammocks or something like that. I'm not sure how to spell it, but I did find them on Google, so it's pretty easy to find. But they make these tiny ultralight hammock type tents, and they actually have covers over them, and you can actually climb into them and zip yourself into them. So basically, if you're looking for something easy to put up that doesn't require a lot of efforts, that might be something worth looking into. And again, it's kind of expensive, but this is the kind of thing where if you buy something that's poorly designed, you're going to realize it, and you're probably going to realize it at 8 o'clock at night when you're trying to put this thing up in the dark and you're struggling and you need help and then you don't have the directions. And it's not a time when you want to be messing around. So definitely spend a lot on a good tent, because that's going to be a lot easier to put up than a really horribly designed $10 thing from Walmart or what have you.
Well, and the good thing is you can take this technology and also use it for emergency preparedness. So what about cooking? Do you buy one of the modern stoves, or do you actually build your own fire?
I just use a propane stove. A lot of the places that I camp and a lot of the areas that I camp, there tends to be a burn ban on. That's something we deal with a lot in Texas. Yeah, I mean, it's just easier to deal with the stove because then you don't have to worry about burn bans. You don't have to worry about checking and seeing if that's not only if one is active, but, you know, those change. I mean, sometimes you go out and you leave for an event and you find out that a burn ban was instituted halfway through it. You just don't want to be in a situation where suddenly you find that you can't cook your food because, you know, fires are off limits.
Food supplies, water do you take, you know, when you're hiking? I don't know how long you're out in the field. What might you be carrying on your back?
Really depends on how long I'm going to be out. If it's a really short hike, or even if I'm just kind of messing around and I'm going to be around a campsite for a day, Camelbacks or any kind of hydration pack is a really, really awesome thing to have. And basically, for people who are not familiar with those, I'd even recommend them for if you're traveling a lot in a city. Basically, what these are is they're little tiny backpacks, and they have usually some storage compartments and things like that. But the big thing is that they have a water reservoir in the backpack. You might have like a 2-liter or maybe a 3-liter or something reservoir of water that you fill up. Along one of the shoulder straps, you have a tube that connects to the reservoir. And then at the end of that tube, you have a little thing that you kind of bite. And then once you bite it, it kind of opens up and then you can suck water out of it. And it's a really great way to carry a large amount of water with you and not have to fight with putting it into a cup or putting it into a thermos or carrying this big bulky thermos around. That's a great thing to have. There's not really much else that I carry that I would say is blindness specific, you know, other than just typical outdoor stuff, sunscreen, food, things like that. As far as what kind of food I bring, I'm a big fan of camping light, and as such, I'm not as big into doing a lot of prep work when I'm out there. So for instance, I might be in a grocery store, I might buy microwavable hamburger patties, because you can just throw those in the stove for like, you know, a few minutes and just make a hamburger or sandwich or something like that, and you're good to go. Or I might, in some situations, prepare stuff at home, like maybe a soup, or prepare like a pasta dish or something like that if I feel like being kind of extravagant. And then I just kind of pack that away and heat it up. So it's a lot easier to kind of heat stuff up when you're there. I know there are some people I camp with who bring entire kitchens, and they bring propane-powered sinks and things like that. And if I'm camping with anybody who has that stuff, I will certainly, you know, chip in and help out and see if we can kind of do things together. But I'm a big fan of preparing things in advance, because you never know what people are going to have and, you know, how prepared they are.
Upcoming, you're actually building your own GPS. I'm guessing an app for what, Android?
Yeah, there is an Android version. Basically, how it works is it is cloud-based. So there is a server that I'm currently running on my computer in my living room right now, which I'm eventually going to move that into like EC2 or something like that. But basically, the server hosts maps, and there's a web front end that you can actually use to browse. So for instance, if you're on your desktop, you can actually browse the map, or even on an iOS device to a limited extent. And then I have built an app for Android that basically connects to a web service. So it connects, it gets information about where you are, what your nearest intersection is, what street you're on, what nearby points of interest there are. I'm using a set of maps that are created by a project called OpenStreetMap, which OpenStreetMap is a world map. So basically anybody can edit it. And in a lot of instances, they go out and they find open data sources that they can actually import. Like, for instance, one that got imported a few years ago was the U.S. Census created some maps. They created some tiger maps, which are very accurate in some areas, not so accurate in others, but they kind of imported all that as sort of a default U.S. map layer. There is a trail on the map, or a river on the map, or something like, or even a swimming pool that's particularly large on the map. This system has no problem browsing. That's something I'm eventually hoping to monetize and, you know, sell a subscription fee, like maybe $5 a month or $10 a month or something like that. But for now, it's kind of a neat project that I'm playing with, and I'm having a lot of fun seeing what's possible and pushing the envelope with that.
Programming on Android obviously is a passion of yours. You created Spiel to give some additional accessibility to Android, and you also were involved in Serotech's release of iBlink Radio 1.0.
Yeah, that's right. I was the contractor you guys brought on board for that, and doing that for the last month or so. And that's been a lot of fun to actually be working on this and actually working on helping an accessibility company come to Android. Because, I mean, it's great that we have mainstream apps on Android that are accessible, but it's really cool to see a company who specializes in accessibility coming to Android. I think that's going to make people take the platform more seriously if a company like you guys is actually investing in the platform and investing in services that are going to bring more blind people to it.
Well, exactly. We certainly feel the need to be cross-platform, Windows, Mac, iOS, and Android, because that is the future.
Absolutely.
Well, very good, Nolan. Thank you for a lot of useful information. Do you have any websites or email address or anything you want to give out for folks to contact you if they have further questions?
I mean, I have quite a few projects that I'm working on and quite a bit of information. I think the easiest thing would be to go, if you're interested in contacting me, wordnerd.info. That's my blog. It links to all my projects. It's not as updated as it probably should be, but there is information on there on how to get in touch with me and such.
Yeah, wordnerd.info. Sounds good. Nolan, thanks a lot for all that you're doing out there to improve accessibility and sharing your information. I was surprised to realize how many blind folks are actually out boating and fishing and camping and really enjoying and making the most of the great outdoors. Well, we're trying a variety of different topics, and those that are received really well, we'll come back and do future shows, and maybe you'll be available on a Thursday or some alternate time, and we'll come back and do it live.
It sounds great.
All right, thank you very much, Nolan. Both those interviews are pre-recorded as we go into a holiday weekend. Many people have things going on, but two, I think, very interesting interviews. Sorry for some of those choppy edits. Good old Skype at its finest. In fact, we were going to have another guest this evening via Skype, and that didn't happen because Skype really wigged out today for myself, and I suspect many other folks as well. But we're going to have Randy Ribs Rustack come on and talk about not only the art of grilling, but smoking meat. So everything happens for a reason. I'm seeing maybe a show. We'll get some great cooks, people who specialize in cooking up different cuisines, and maybe that'd be a great... That might be kind of a nice show to do, but we thought we'd spend our last few minutes in the actual tech room on SAMNet. That's where we go after the tech chats take place and just speak with some users who have come in and kind of find out what they do for outdoor recreational type fun. And we'll see who we have in here with us this evening. And well, I see Mr. Pete. Okay. I see Mr. Pete Bosley here, and I know he does some stuff outdoors. Pete, what do you consider outdoor recreation? What do you do when you're not slaving away at the job?
Well, I do a little bit of camping, like some of the other people were talking about. Not so much fishing, but things on the river, whitewater rafting. I do a little bit of canoeing. And then I've done skydiving a couple of times as part of a class, but I don't get out to do that very much because it's pretty expensive.
So when you go camping, do you do it in a more of a modern way, or do you do kind of rough it and go back to toughen it out? Where are you with that?
Well, I used to do it kind of the rough way. More recently, just because I've been going with other people and sometimes needed to be available for work, I've kind of shied away from the rough stuff, but I do enjoy doing that.
Okay, we can open up for questions here, although keep in mind all our guests were pre-recorded, so maybe more than questions, if you have any anything you'd like to share, maybe some good websites for different things, whether it be, camping gear or whatever, or maybe you're into grilling and smoking meats and you want to share some great sites, be it for recipes or just tips or techniques, anything that takes us outside of our home or apartments and kind of gets us out into the mix. That would be kind of what we want to talk about in the remaining few minutes. While we enable the questions here, I want to invite you to join us next week. On the 2nd, we will do our This Month in Access Technology. We'll talk about some of the top tech stories for May. And our next podcast, of course, as well, around the 7th, should cover some of the interesting stuff to come out of WWDC. We'll see what Apple has to announce. And, of course, there'll be a lot of other tech events taking place in June as well. So we'll do our event for June on the end of the month, the 30th. But next week we'll do that. And as you notice now, we have a sponsor and want to thank the folks at Vanda Pharmaceuticals. They are conducting a clinical sleep research trial. And not only can you possibly improve your quality of sleep, which affects productivity and mood and relationships and everything else, but you might also, if you qualify, be compensated for your work. So certainly nothing wrong with that. And you can check that out at serotalk.com, and we'll be glad to let you know that we will be speaking with Joe Hall over at Harvard and Brigham Women's Hospital on June 9th, as well as Willie Hoos. So if you had some more questions about sleep, we did a great tech chat about a year ago, a lot of interest there, so join us for that. We're trying to round up some folks from the different organizations, ACB and NFB, so if that all goes well, we'll be able to do a show each week and talk with them about specifically what's going on at their respective conventions, and just a lot of good stuff. And as always, submit your suggestions. We got a lot of great input that the show for the ladies last week was a big success. Many enjoyed it, but also said, hey, let's talk about fashion for men. What can make us guys look better? So all that stuff coming up. And so, Pete, now you do have a little bit of vision, but I'm curious. I mean, you do canoeing and so forth. That's a little bit of labor involved there. And I know someone also sent me some links for rowing, and I'm like, oh, I mean boats without motors, right? So
yeah, it is kind of brutal sometimes. But you can tell you what, it's good for the arms and good for the chest muscles. So I don't know about rowing. Rowing seems a little hardcore, but
yeah, it's good what I thought. So maybe we do another outdoor show again based on the popularity of the show and the comments that we get. Maybe we'll get a gentleman on from the UK to talk about that, and maybe some other folks will bring out of the club. I wasn't aware. I mean, did you have an annual fishing tournament with over 500 blind people? I wasn't aware.
Wow, I'm surprised we haven't heard about that before.
Yeah, I really am. That just goes to show you there's so much taking place that we're not even necessarily aware of. You know, of course, you have to look in the right place. But we're down a couple minutes left, so if anyone has any questions. But I don't know, Pete, you've... do you do any outdoor grilling? You got any tips? I was hoping to have someone on and get in the Skype. We're definitely like Twit and Leo looking for some alternate technologies to do our chat because it's just, you heard a choppy audio even in the interviews I got on Skype. It's just really going downhill.
I do grill a little bit outside. Nothing fancy, though. I'm probably not what you would consider a pro. I've managed to avoid burning my deck down, so that's about all that can be said for me.
Gas or charcoal?
Gas.
Yeah, I like to dabble in that. It's nothing like the taste of meat on the grill, definitely.
The charcoal grilling definitely tastes better, but the time and labor involved in getting that going is just more than I want to deal with.
Yeah, and there's always a challenge of making sure things cook evenly. You get the flame even, you don't have too much charcoal on one side of the pit. So, but definitely tastes better if you get it done. And that's the way I started out. And like you said, gas is kind of a convenience thing. You get it fired up real quickly and get in and out.
This is kind of an interesting topic because you wouldn't think of it for blind people doing these things normally. But given where I'm geographically located here in Western Canada, sports and recreational activities are quite common. So like when I was 16, I did a lot of skiing.
Okay, that is Corey from Canada joining us. Yeah, so it is more prevalent, you think, maybe there. I mean, well, we certainly have it here in the States as well, and they have the USABA. But, you know, you snow skiing and fishing and a lot of this stuff is just more common. It's just something that they seem to get more people per capita involved in.
Yeah, well, that's what everybody here does. So when I was a kid, we'd always be off camping, and my family, you know, we didn't go to a campground. We'd go into the bush, so you'd go to a field or something and create your own fire pit, get some rocks, and you know, you can't really do it anymore. They really frown on it now, but you know, say 10 years ago or whatever, or 15 or whatever, that sort of thing, nobody really minded so much if you were respectful of it. And so, you know, clean up your stuff when you leave and everything, but you know, it's a little different world now. So but, yeah, so, I mean, I've done a lot of that in terms of, you know, fishing, lake fishing, creek fishing. You know, I can't say I'm an avid cook outside, but, you know, roasting stuff over a fire, you know, because we didn't really, like, we obviously had camp stoves and everything, but a lot of it would just, you know, you get the cooking fork and you just hold it out over the flames and, you know, it's kind of a matter of timing, just like cooking on a stove, in a way you kind of have to, and keeping in terms of the heat level and how high above the fire you position your food, say it's a hot dog, let's say, so you want to make sure it's not in the fire and not too high above it, because otherwise if it's too high above it, it won't do anything, and if it's in it, you'll burn it, so, you know, it's kind of a toss-up, and certainly having someone that's sighted can help, but it is doable if you can't see it. So it just takes practice.
Well, I use foil. I don't know if that's cheating or not, but it seems to work for me.
Hey, you know, whatever works, right? You don't want to eat burned meat, so.
Yeah, generally not good times. But that's going to put the... someone had a final comment here. We're going to put the wraps on it for tonight, but... Okay, well, hearing nothing, we will invite you to join us next week for this month in Access Technology. We will have Michael Barber, Curtis Chong, and I believe one other person as well, as we'll talk about the big access and some of the mainstream tech news stories. Microsoft buying Skype. Let's hope they can turn it around. And Google applying.
Don't hold your breath.
Yeah, Google applying for autonomous driving out in Nevada. That to me is a very interesting story. But anyway, all that coming up for you next week. And until then, I would basically, as we always say, invite everyone to, what do we say? Stay connected and stay directed.
This concludes another Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected.